At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible. Please visit audiblepodcast.com/GOT for your free audiobook download. This episode is also brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace is the easiest way to create beautiful websites, blogs, or online stores for you and your ideas. Squarespace features an elegant interface, beautiful templates, and incredible 24/7 customer support. Try Squarespace at squarespace.com and enter offer code GOT at checkout to get 10% off. Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
And I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 5, Episode 7, entitled The Gift. We have some stuff to get to before we get into the episode, right?
Yeah, I just wanted to let people know, because I know a lot of people have been on the sidelines about it, but we are now accepting credit cards straight up via Stripe for Club Bald Move, if you want to get in on the Club Bald Move action. Yeah, it's no longer shackled to PayPal. Well, though, we still got that. It's an either or. It's an AC/DC kind of thing. We got you coming and going.
Different strokes, you know?
For different folks. Also want to let everyone, and I do mean everyone, I got it every way you can possibly get a message short of Pony Express, that the PS4 does now support HBO Go. I got it in PS4 messages. I got it in email. I got it on Facebook.
Sony themselves were like, nope,
I got
like,
on the forums.
Nope.
Yep, nope. The CEO of Sony flew over from Japan and set me straight. And they gave me a cool sword, dude. That was pretty cool.
Oh, nice. What's it called?
It's called the PS Sword. I don't...
okay.
I caught me flat-footed there.
I know. Sorry about that.
I will say, though, that I don't... The streaming ability of it seems to leave a lot to be desired. It's very blocky and de-resed a lot. And, like, I've been streaming HBO Go from my phone because it's got Chromecast and all that shit. And, you know, my cell phone can do it no problem. So I think the PlayStation 4 is more powerful than my cell phone.
Pretty sure, yeah.
One other thing, I got a bunch of people alerting me to the fact that Coldplay did a charity video for this Red Nose event, which I guess is a bunch of comedians getting together for some nebulously defined purpose to do good in the United States and throughout the world. But you can see their pitch on the video. They did a Game of Thrones, the musical, like the making of. It's 12 minutes long. And I will warn you that 4 minutes in, you're like, this is the lamest thing I've ever seen. But it starts to pick up, and I think it's actually worth watching. It's pretty well done towards the end. Okay. There's a really funny Theon moment in the thing. And Daenerys, the actual Emile Clarke, gets to sing Rastafarian Targaryen.
All right. Sounds awesome.
Pretty good. Pretty good. Lots of cast and crew appearing on that video. So check it out. I'll put a link in the show notes, but you can it's easy to find Coldplay, Game of Thrones, the musical, if I forget, as I'm wont to do.
Okay. Sounds good. Let's get into the recap.
Can I talk about, speaking of production, can I talk a little bit about the men responsible for this episode?
Oh, yeah. I guess we're still doing that old thing.
I guess, despite logic and reason and in public interest. It's directed by Miguel Sapochnik.
Okay.
And he is executive produced and directed a 2010 film, Repo Man, which was starring Jude Law and Forest Whitaker.
Yeah, I saw that.
I did too. It was his directorial debut, but he's also directed TV episodes such as House MD, episodes of Fringe and Awake, and also a television show I've never heard of called Mind Games. Mm-hmm. And it looks like he got his start in film by being a storyboard artist on the film Trainspotting.
Wow.
So okay. He's really started from the bottom. Now he's here. And is written by the Double Ds, David and Benioff and Daniel Weiss. So
of course.
There we go. And we kind of talked about what we thought about the episode on the instant cast, but I just reiterate on my subsequent watchings, I enjoyed it Probably more than I have the last three episodes.
Yeah, I think I have too. There were spots where I was like, eh, not so great. But I think the ending of this episode and a lot of the stuff that happens along the way is really good. It's really good. And I was excited by the end of this, by the possibilities.
Discover why critics are calling Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes the best film of the franchise.
What a wonderful day!
It's a jaw-dropping spectacle that demands to be seen on the biggest screen possible.
We need to go.
Hang on.
It is our time.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, now playing only in theaters. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Let's get into it then.
Okay, we start off with John readying to leave Castle Black. And they bring out Tormund. They set him free. Everybody's like, I don't like this.
Yep.
Especially Alistair. He walks up, gives command of Castle Black to Alistair, and he basically says, I think this is a shit idea.
Mm-hmm.
It's my job to inform you that you're a fucking idiot.
Yeah.
That sort of
your
thing.
Your shit's all fucked up, and you talk like a southerner.
And then Sam gives John some dragon glass.
Yeah.
And then John heads out.
My only, so I got a couple of observations here. Number one, as I mentioned in the instant cast, seems like the first thing you do is break that dragon glass down to arrowheads.
Okay.
I mean, job number one.
Mm-hmm. Can you do that on the road?
I would imagine. I would imagine. Job number one is actually for Stannis to dispatch a crack mining crew to Dragonstone and get as much of that shit as possible.
They need Ygritte here, right?
What?
Like to make those arrowheads.
There you go.
And she can make arrows, no problem.
Just right in a field. No problem at all.
Maybe they should train Ollie to do it.
Step two is definitely to break this down into dragonglass. Ollie more kills archers. I don't think he actually makes...
Okay.
He's not a bower. Do you think that John suspected the complete viper's nest he was leaving Sam behind in?
It didn't seem like it.
Because on the second watch, it actually looked like, the recognizable faces that we know support Sam are John and Ed.
Mm-hmm.
And both of those guys are riding north to this Hardhome location. Sam is left behind with Sir Alistair Thorne. Now, maybe John thought better of him.
Because, of Alistair?
Yeah, because I was kind of disappointed, too. I thought he just came across as a giant asshole in this episode.
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple of ways of reading the scene where he says, you're losing all your friends to Ollie.
Yeah.
One
is watch your caboose.
Yeah, one is a warning. The other is a threat.
I took it as the threat. But you got a good
point
there. I kind
of did the first time, too, and then I read, I think it was on the forums. Some people were talking about it, and...
Mm-hmm.
They made the point, it could also just be a warning. And the second time through, I was kind of looking for that. So I was like, I guess it could be.
I
guess it depends on your reading there.
And I always thought that he is an interesting character because it's not hard to imagine him as a Jon Snow type that came to the wall and then he's just been ground down by 20, 30 years of futility and bullshit and dealing with these idiots. So I more sympathetic than I think a lot of show watchers are to his character, but he just seems like a giant asshole. I mean, it'd been cool if Sam had said, "Yeah, same thing to you, buddy. I just saw, I saw your number one fan get his head removed. So what do you got?"
Yeah, the more I think about the Night's Watch, I'm thinking, why does the realm trust this group of doofuses to protect them? They're the only thing standing between them and winter, ostensibly,
right? They take it serious.
They don't take winter
they
seriously?
They take guarding the wall roughly as serious as we take, guarding the Canadian border.
Okay.
It doesn't even come to our... We're not even... The thought that Canada would invade us is not even something that we occupy. There's never been a movie made, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. There's been one in reverse, South Park, Bigger, Longer, Uncut, of course.
No, there's one called Maple Dawn.
Really?
Yeah.
But, they just don't... The thought that it would actually be a serious invasion of wildlings, first of all, it'd be a northern problem.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the realm just doesn't give a shit. Number two, it doesn't seem serious. The last thing time that shit really seriously went down was thousands and thousands of years ago.
Hmm.
On that type of a human time span, it's kind of amazing that they still... keep that institution alive in the form that it is.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, one could argue you could just leave the wall up there and then just have the Northern Lords ride down any wildling raiding parties and just fuck the whole thing.
Sure.
The wall itself is kind of...
Now it's just like a punishment.
Yeah, it really is. It's a penal colony.
Hmm. Okay. Anyway, we go to Master Aemon, and he is sick in bed. Sam and Gilly are bringing him a baby to pet. I don't know. He likes petting babies. He likes it. He tells him, bring the baby south before it's too late.
Yeah.
A warning to them. What do you make of that? Like, Sam has no friends up here. They're actively trying to rape Gilly during this episode. Do you think he heeds that advice? Says, you know what? I'm going to break my vows because these are a bunch of losers anyway.
I'm not sure, because it might surprise you to know that this is not how it happens in the books.
No, yeah, I know that.
So, I don't know. I mean, it seems clear that, I don't know, Sam, if he has Ghost with him, can hold off the Black Brothers for as long as he needs.
That's true.
But also, we've seen the limits of what a direwolf can do in, you know, the aftermath of the Red Wedding, like against a bunch, you know, if like the Black Brothers decide, all right, we're going to get 12 of us together with crossbows and spears and we're going to kill this thing so we can have our way with Sam. There's nothing stopping him. So it does seem like it is a position that he cannot hold.
I wonder if that will be the determining factor. Like they come after Ghost and he goes up, time to head out.
Well, I mean, like I said, I hope he doesn't wait that long because I like Ghost and I don't want him dead.
Sure, yeah.
And he's just a fucking direwolf, so
yeah,
he's not cunning. He's not cunning like a man.
I'm not saying he deserves it.
Yeah.
But these are shits up there. So.
Sure, sure.
Reek brings Sansa some food, and she pleads with him to help her out of this tower she's in, or this cell, basically. She tells him, light a candle in the tower, someone will come help. Reek takes the candle up to the tower where Ramsay is waiting for him.
Yeah.
First reaction on this was, oh my God, Reek is in a ton of trouble.
Sure.
Because I felt like he might actually be helping her here.
I did too, because...
And Ramsay was just waiting for him.
Yeah. The way the scene was filmed, I was starting like, I don't know if I buy that he would actually turn at this point. If he wasn't going to turn in the end of last episode, then why would he hear... but the way they shot it, I don't know. I'm saying I don't know a lot this episode. I apologize. I don't know what to say because I felt like what we got here as payoff is kind of lame. And if they were going to do, I thought there was other interesting things they could have done with Ramsay, the setup here that they didn't. And I don't, but I, you know, I know that's like so boorish to be like, oh, well, they should have done it this way and have been brilliant or everything had gone great. So I don't know. To me, this is just an indictment of the candle strategy.
Okay.
Like, Brienne, it's just another instance of her naivete. She sees Littlefinger and Sansa at the club and she gets down on one knee and pledges fealty instead of like hanging back and then making an observation. Here she's like, oh, light this candle, and then we find out that Sansa's locked in a cell, getting abused on a nightly basis, and she has no one that she can rely on. So
sure.
It's just another instance of Brienne cannot conceive, despite everything she's been through, that there are people this horrible, that like she picks a fairy. I mean, that's something you read out of a fairy tale, right? Light this candle in the highest tower of highest window of the broken tower. That's
yeah. Then let your hair out the window and I'll climb up to save you.
Like, and I wonder if that's deliberate because I kind of think that's interesting to show that she is kind of stuck in this. She's living a fairy tale version of a knight still, which is kind of an endearing quality about her. But it ain't helping Sansa a whit.
That's true. That's true. I think maybe eventually Reek will turn back to Theon. But I'm also glad that they didn't have him do that immediately.
Yeah, and I will say that, you know, we've talked about this a lot, last episode, that the whole idea of putting into Reek's head that he's Theon Greyjoy, having him play that role, and then Sansa, I do think it felt like she got through a little bit, like a little crack in his mind pried open. Not enough, but... Ramsay's playing with fire, continually allowing him to explore that duality about his character. I feel like I'm not a psychologist.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting. I'm still really enjoying that part of the show.
Yep.
So there's a real quick shot of Brienne observing the tower, and nothing's happening. And then we go over
that's
to...
That's other fave. How long is a candle last, you think? A couple hours?
Yeah.
Is Brienne watching this at 3 o'clock in the morning? Is her and Pod watching in shifts?
Probably,
is Pod falling asleep like a jackass? Yes. Like, this plan is fraught with peril.
Sure. Not the greatest plan.
Winter's coming. You just going to sit there in the exposed open air and wait for this fucking candle?
I guess so. Their horses are going to die.
they don't have 47 to lose.
They do not. Aemon's hallucinating. He's got fever dreams here. He's calling out the egg, and then he dies.
Yeah.
And the next day we see Sam speaking at his funeral where they burn his body. And then Alistair tells Sam, "You're losing all your friends, Tarly." And Sam sees some dude eyeing him. What is this guy's name? I don't even remember.
They are doing, I feel like that there is, there's an attempt to have us get some screen time with some of the big wigs of the Night's Watch. Like they've talked about the first builder and the first steward and all this other stuff. They're trying to get them established to what end, I don't know. But I feel like that they are trying to get some screen time to some villains, some new villains at the Wall, since we've lost, you know, a lot of recognizable faces in the carnage of last season.
Sure. Yeah, a lot of them.
But I don't know how, I mean, you're not a book reader. How effective is it? Are any of these faces sticking at least?
Yeah, I think the redhead guy is going to stick this time.
It's always the ginger.
Yeah, but he's not like a first builder or anything like that, is he?
He's just an asshole.
Yeah, sure.
He's either a horse thief, a murderer, or a rapist.
Or all of the above.
And now he's got attempted rapist, whichever to whatever is being added to. There's a lot of really cool nods, like this whole sequence of him crying out for egg and I dreamed that I was old. It's a very poignant scene from the books, and I thought it translated well.
Yeah, I don't know what that's all about.
So his brother was Aegon, who was known in his youth as Egg, and there's a whole chronicles of like in a graphic novel form and some short stories about the Duncan Egg travels about when he was a boy. So this is kind of like fan service for the not just book readers, but the people that have gone and read like the novellas and chronicles and all that
extended
stuff.
Universe stuff.
But this particular scene when he refers to that, that kind of like unites those stories together, and he's old. Mm-hmm. He's almost 100 years old.
Yeah, and he's an old dude.
There was an interesting thing on the inside edition of Game of Thrones where the producers were talking about how they think Aemon was the first person to die of natural causes on the show.
Yeah,
they're
probably right.
And that he also served as the moral compass and kind of like the counselor for Jon and Sam, and that's intended to show to be a commentary on the world. Which I thought, yeah, like I said, I thought it was appropriately somber and mournful. And it's too damn bad that John wasn't there to see it.
Sure. I like how, I don't know who, like, what is Sam at this point? Sam isn't like a first builder. Sam isn't
He was the steward of, what do you call that? What did they call John? John was the steward of the old bear, right?
Of something, yeah.
I think he was the personal steward of Master Aemon.
So, all right. So that must be why he's speaking here then.
Mm-hmm. That's what I took it, yeah.
Yeah, because otherwise, like, they pass the torch around to several people who light the corners, and I was wondering what the significance of all those people are. Alistair is obviously Lord Commander.
He's the first, at
the moment.
Acting Lord Commander, First Ranger. Yeah. I think it's like First Ranger, First Builder, First Steward, whoever the leader of the various factions. Because you got the fighters, you got the builders.
So does Sam, become the de facto replacement for...
I honestly couldn't tell you. I would be surprised because I feel like that would be jumping several rungs of Black Brother hierarchy. But then again, Jon Snow's Lord Commander.
Also,
I don't think that's an elected
position
either. I think that's something that the Lord Commander would appoint.
Oh, okay.
But again, I don't really know. I don't know the politics of that. I don't think we've seen it.
So I guess depending on what you think of Alistair, Sam might be in line for that.
Yeah, and whatever he does, if John makes it back safe and sound,
yeah,
if he makes it back safe and sound, then I would think that he could do whatever the hell he wants.
Sure, sure.
Like, whatever Sam, you know, if Sam is chief stable scrubber, he could elevate him to...
Which he will be by the end of this, I'm sure.
If it's up to Alistair.
He's the only guy equipped, in my opinion, to even come close to replacing Maester Aemon.
But we haven't seen any of these guys.
That's true. I mean, of the people we've seen, I guess. Yeah.
I mean, like, you know, we've seen this like long haul of all the brothers. There's like maybe 100 all told from all the different places after, again, the carnage of last season.
Yeah.
But we don't know any of them. So
sure.
I don't know if there's any likely candidates. There's any first stewards of Eastwatch by the Bay or the Shadow Tower, who knows?
All right, let's move on. Ramsay lays out the situation with Stannis to Sansa. He says Stannis is coming down here, but they've got weather on their side, basically. And then she says, you know, you've got an unborn brother on the way. He's bragging about, oh, I'm going to be the Warden of the North, and you'll be my lady and all this stuff. And she's like, you got a little brother on the way, and he's got a much stronger claim to this warden position than you do. So are you worried about that? And Ramsay tries to play it off.
I will say this about Sansa. She is not afraid of Ramsay. Not in this, you know.
I mean, what else can he do to her, right?
That's the thing. Do you think that Sansa knows that she is untouchable in the sense that he can't, like, maim or kill her? He can torment her
like
in
she
other
knows
ways.
That.
Really?
Yeah.
Because I think that's the one other kind of disappointment, is I was really hoping to see a scene of Roos, you know, kind of like taking Ramsay to task for failing yet again to learn the lesson he's trying to patiently teach him. Like, look, you can be a sadistic asshole. You just kind of keep it on the down low.
Yeah.
And you can't treat your wife this way. Because
do it where it's appropriate.
Yes. And go to the cruelty room.
Yeah.
That's where you keep the cruelty contained.
Don't take the important people there with you.
They leave all the people that, you know, people would care about.
Yeah.
Out of the situation.
So then Ramsay tells her that Jon is Lord Commander of the Night's Watch, which she didn't know.
It seemed to really blow her hair back.
Yeah, seemed like it.
Any wheels turning in her head about that?
I don't know. I don't know what that gets her at this point.
It gets her a sympathetic man with a military force backing him.
Yeah, like a military force, though.
Yeah,
compared to Bruce's force.
Sure.
I mean, he's not worried about Stannis. He's sure as hell not worried about the Night's Watch.
If Sansa doesn't know about Jon, I feel like there's no way she knows about Stannis. Although, no,
well,
she does. Yeah, Littlefinger told her. Never mind. Retracted.
Well, Ramsay tells her in that scene.
Does he?
Yeah.
Okay.
Stannis is on his way. Anyway, then he takes her over to see the woman he's killed, the woman who said the North remembers when she arrived. A couple of things here. First of all, how the hell does he know who this lady is and that this lady was helping Sansa?
That's
like,
a good
I watched these scenes multiple times trying to figure out how he spotted her.
That's a good
how
question.
He sussed her out, and I couldn't determine it.
Yeah, that's a good question. It could be that he did some rough interrogation of other people at Winterfell and led. I mean, I don't know. And I don't know that it's one of those things where it's like, I don't think it's super important for us to know.
Yeah.
But I think it's plausible that he could torture a few people. I mean, how many people have been in contact with Sansa? That list is probably vanishingly small. He can't torture Fat Waldo. He can't torture his father. Theon turn cloak on her, so
yeah.
There's not a whole lot of people that list could be.
Okay.
Then the thing is that I feel like that this is showing us that Ramsay's kind of an idiot, because to torture someone to death and not have any scope about, like, he doesn't know if there's a person on the other side of the wall, if there's 100, if there's 1,000, if it's the whole fucking united force of the great northern houses.
It's Stannis.
And Stannis, that they're, yeah. Uh-huh. That, I mean, it seemed foolhardy, and I think we're supposed to see him as kind of, again, short-sighted and puts his own passions above what's right for him and his house.
Yeah, I think you're right. If that's not what they intend here, or, you know, over the course of the last couple episodes, then I think they're making a mistake.
Right.
But I'm going to go with that for now.
Did you think that him half expecting a fat bearded beast was a shot at Sam?
Oh, no. I thought it was a shot at his father's wife.
Well, to be fair, Fat Waldo has no beard.
Okay. True. But
nor
like
is she
he
a
expected,
beast.
He's like, oh, here's my father's standards. Here's what I'm going to get.
True.
It's probably what he expected.
Did you of course notice she grabbed that corkscrew?
Yeah,
which I apparently is the proper term is called a bung bore.
It's
the device that you use to bore a hole through like a cask of ale or whatever. Mm. Which I'm not going to make any jokes because that wouldn't be appropriate in these circumstances.
Of course not.
But she has a perfectly good neck chain spike if she needs to do some shivving. What's the deal with this corkscrew?
I didn't see her wearing the necklace this time.
Did well, you? No, but I mean, do you
I wonder
think
if it's Taken? Because she doesn't have like the clothes that she had before. She looks like she's in some kind of like just undergarment.
Yeah, yeah.
I wonder if that's all been taken from her.
I don't know. That's a good question.
I mean, I think she. I don't know if she's going to try and kill Ramsay with this. I think that's probably a bad idea.
Well, there are some sharp-eyed fans that notice that there's a great deal of similarity between this tool that she picked up and the tool that Ramsay was using to torture Theon's foot in an earlier season, like that little foot screw thing.
All right.
Do you think that will be turned against Ramsay? Do you think that Sansa might try to get the upper hand with Theon by torturing him?
That's what
like,
I was,
if
you,
you're afraid
of
Ramsay,
yeah.
well... You know,
wow, that's dark.
Yeah, no, just but turnabout, I would say is fair play in this case.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know where that's going. I think all of that is a possibility. But it would be a little foolish to try to kill Ramsay because if she doesn't succeed, she's in super hot
that's
water
the thing.
And she's probably going to get killed.
It seems like a suicide mission.
Yeah, if she does succeed, how does she get out of there?
That's what I'm saying. It's a suicide mission, regardless.
I mean,
of
she'd have to go up to the
not.
Tower, light the candle, and just
yep.
sit there and hope, that
why the candle is conspicuously lit.
Yeah, and while like, I mean, unless she's gonna like thief it and hide his body in a cask or something,
full on Splinter Cell.
Yeah,
Sansa agent.
I don't know. It's
Are you surprised we haven't seen Miranda? Which, if you're not up on her name, that's Ramsay's favorite torture horror.
Yeah. It didn't seem like that was over by a long shot.
Do you think we are going to find out what happened to it and we're not going to like it? Because
oh boy.
Last we saw, she was given Sansa's unauthorized sass.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the last we've literally seen of her.
I think so.
All right.
Yeah,
I don't know where she
is.
I don't know where that's going, but probably bad places.
Probably.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move. Our coverage of Hot D, Fire and Blood, and the 1980s Shogun miniseries continues, but then on Tuesday, for the first time in 35 years, we asked a question, who framed Roger Rabbit? Hop aboard the train to Toontown as we revisit this incredible blending of live action and animation to see if it still holds up all this time later.
Then on Wednesday, we get our first look at Blake Crouch's mind-bending sci-fi series, Dark Matter. The first two episodes drop simultaneously on Apple TV Plus, and we'll have a pair of podcasts quantumly linked ready for you to observe.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
So we go to Davos up in the north. He comes into Stannis. He tells him, we're losing horses, we're losing food and men to the weather. And he tries to convince Stannis to go back to Castle Black for the winter. And Stannis says, no way. We're doing this now. And then when he leaves, Stannis asks Melisandre if she's sure about this whole thing. She is, but she also wants to burn Shireen or eat her heart or something. I don't know.
Right.
Whatever this witch does. Stannis tells her to go fuck herself.
Yep.
Good job. Good job, Stannis. You've finally done something that I appreciate.
Sure. But telling her to fuck off is not going to bring the Stormcrows back, and it's not going to bring the horses back. Although,
it's true.
There, to a certain extent, this is a supply and demand problem. The men are hungry. The horses are dead. The men can eat the horses. Everybody's happy. Except for the poor fuckers that have to walk through the massive winter snowdrifts.
Yeah. Yeah. I honestly didn't realize that the winter was going to come this fast, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they've been, it's been four and a half seasons now, and it's like, is this winter ever going to come? So now it's starting to actually affect Stannis. And I didn't think it was going to affect him that much, but, you know, he's removing pieces from his board, literally.
I enjoyed that aspect, too.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if they're doing enough to sell the harsh Westerosi winter yet.
Yeah, because I didn't feel like it was enough to kill anybody.
Like, I don't think you'd cancel school with that kind of snow, let alone cancel your desperate march to Winterfell.
If you're in Atlanta, you do.
And I've seen them do like convincing like snowstorms and stuff before in the show.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking of like, you know, that first scene in season two, like the aftermath of the Battle of the First Men, where Sam is kind of lost in the snow.
Yep.
They can do that. So I'm kind of surprised they didn't show it as more than a mild inconvenience.
Yeah.
Like, that's snow angel weather. That's not, oh my God, horses are freezing to death weather.
Yeah, I mean, they made a point of them just not being prepared for it, I guess. You know, like, the people in the north all have big, thick coats, and they know how to survive in this weather, and Stannis armies really don't.
Yeah.
So I guess that's the only factor there that would be...
They're not equipped for winter. That's a good point, but still. But still.
It does make me wonder how bad it's going to be for Jon. Because John's going the other direction.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
And if people and horses are dying going south, you got to imagine north is worse.
Yep. Yep, good point.
Oh, boy. I don't know what else to say about this other than I'm super glad that Stannis is refusing to kill Shireen. And I kind of agree with his idea of what needs to go on here. If he retreats to Castle Black and waits out the winter, who knows how long it'll be, and someone else will be on the throne.
Yeah.
Especially
this winter, which could be especially a bad winter. It could be filled with ice zombies. I mean, that's the reason that he went to the wall in the first place.
Yeah.
To defend the realms of men. It could be a real shit show, sure.
Yeah. So if he waits, I don't know that he'll get another opportunity. Anyway, Gilly's doing laundry when a couple of brothers come in and try to rape her. Sam tries to stop them, but they beat him up. Fortunately, he is able to stall them long enough for Ghost to come in and run the brothers off before Gilly's harmed.
Yeah, they really beat the shit out of him.
Oh, my God.
He's like Homer Simpson level taking headshots in this.
The kick to the face, especially.
Yeah.
Didn't even lose any teeth.
No.
He's good for him.
He needs those teeth. They've been grown strong through years of chomping.
I imagine he could probably take a punch. He's a pretty thick dude.
Yeah, heck yeah.
But he took a lot of punches.
He took a lot of punches. Might be a little punch drunk.
Yeah. He still has one friend, Ghost.
Yeah, well, what the hell, Ghost? Is he just kind of licking himself in the corner, waiting for the dramatically appropriate time to growl menacingly? It's like, you know, I thought you had him, Sam, but I guess I'll get, you know, as much as I'm enjoying this whole licking myself thing, I guess I'll come and bare my teeth for you.
Yeah, I don't know. Ghost knows how to make a dramatic entrance.
Sure. No, I enjoyed seeing him.
Yeah.
Been too long since we've seen some direwolf action.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm a big fan of Sam, so I like to see him, you know, despite the odds, standing up for Gilly here.
I wish he'd done some kind of damage to those guys. Because he has killed a White Walker and a Thin. I mean...
Yeah.
I get it that he's pathetic and all that, but...
I was definitely rooting for him,
too. He's also swinging a sword.
Yeah.
I thought, like, he wouldn't kill the guys, but maybe he'd give him a scar or something.
Cut their arm.
Yeah, there you go. Like
Bronn got. I don't know. Anyway, we see right after that that Gilly's telling Sam that he shouldn't have helped her out, but Sam instead vows to take care of her and little Sam, and then Gilly humps him.
Yep.
Climbs on top of that beast and rides it.
Yep. She took, when Master Aemon said, you need to take care of little Sam, I think she got her wires crossed.
Oh, God.
Because.
Oh, no.
Also, another conveniently well-behaved baby. That baby, when you need him to, will just sit in the corner and sit through hours of sex position.
Apparently so.
Involving Sam and Gilly.
All right, let's move on.
Oh, special Jorah. Treat. I this is the passage I'm going to recount in our Audible ad for this week.
Is it particularly funny in the book?
Well, first of all, George R. R. Martin sex scenes are a thing of awe and wonder.
Okay.
And this is perhaps the best example.
Are they just awkward? Oh, well, you'll
find out.
We'll
hear I don't want to spoil the surprise. Okay.
I appreciate that. So we go up to Jorah. He's being sold to slavers, and Tyrion manages to weasel his way into also being bought by the same slaver.
Yeah.
And then they head out. I guess this slaver buys Tyrion because he's funny. A dwarf beating a man is funny.
Right. And there's a lot of some Easter eggs for book readers, because Jorah, he talks about he was like the first one through the walls of Spike. Is a corruption of the invasion of Pike when they're putting down the first Greyjoy rebellion. He was actually one of the first few men through the wall, but the real first man through the wall was Thoros of Myr, last seen resurrecting Beric Dondarrion with his flaming sword. All this is just being I like the game of telephone, that they're using obscure book battles and mashing up the details, and then Jorah's face is sitting there like, okay, sure. Sure. I was the first one through Spike with my flaming sword, and I killed Khal Drogo with it. Why not?
Yeah, yeah. I did notice that it changed from killing one of Khal Drogo's assistants or whatever to actually him.
It's literally a game of telephone.
Good stuff. I mean, the slaver wants to get as much as he can for his merchandise. No cock merchants found in this group, unfortunately. I would have liked to have seen what a cock merchant looks like.
How
he signifies himself.
You know, you bake one cake, and it doesn't make you a baker. But you sell one cock, you're a cock merchant. I submit you have seen a cock merchant, and he is the dude that sold Tyrion.
Okay. Fair enough.
Although it was for his wit, not his member. So maybe not. Technicality.
I felt like this was stretching it a little bit. The Tyrion. Tyrion has talked his way into...
Tyrion's member?
No.
I don't think it needs Tyrion... it. I mean, the reputation is there. It speaks for itself.
It's full size, you know? I felt like it was a stretch for him to once again talk his way out of a bad situation.
Uh-huh.
There was no reason for this guy to buy him.
Sure.
Him being funny...
No, this is
that really the reason he's buying him?
This is a total C-3PO R2-D2 moment.
Yeah.
I need this guy for some weirdly defined purpose. You gotta have him.
Yeah, I really didn't like it very much.
The subsequent movie series and television show will not work unless we take him as set. So obviously, despite all rational logic, you have to take us. But, you know, I love Star Wars. I can't argue. I can't argue with what they're doing here in Game of Thrones.
Yeah. I do like that. He tries to press his luck even further, and he gets smacked in the face for it.
Picks the wrong shop to preach labor laws and minimum wage and all that. No.
Yeah, well, he has a good point. You know, they're going to Marine. The slaves are free there. You can't walk in with a couple of slaves in shackles.
Can't you?
Apparently you can.
Because that's the thing. I wonder if that's a little sly commentary for people to are thinking this through hard. It's like, well, but wait a second. You can have, whoosh, you know, that's the double D's essentially giving you, just shut up, you.
Yeah.
Shut up, you.
And it could also be saying that, you know, Danny's will is not necessarily being enforced in that city.
Yeah. But I like the double D's saying look, we are essentially trying to condense 477 pages into 3 scenes. Shut the fuck up. Shut the fuck up.
All right. Let's move on. Dario and Danny are laying in bed. Dario's trying to figure out why Danny married his Dar. He half jokingly suggests that Danny marry him instead. I felt like that was kind of a joke, but
was it
just testing the waters? I don't know.
I think that's kind of the feeling you're supposed to get.
Okay. I felt like he wanted to, but he wasn't going to outright suggest it in more than a joking way.
Yeah, I feel like the Dario is a very hard guy to pin down.
Okay.
Unless you're Danny and you roll on top of him. But he's kind of hard. He's a little slippery.
All right. Well, he's a sweaty guy, you know, he fights a lot.
That's true.
So she says, nah, no thanks. And he tells her that she should kill all the masters during the Great Games.
I feel like that's sound advice. This path of the middle pleasing no one is not working.
Yeah, I mean, he susses out, you know, exactly what I suspected last episode, which is she's marrying Hisdar to try this political quelling of the uprising. I don't know. There are indications that it's working.
Here's the thing. Dany's playing fuck, kill, marry with Meereen, and her answer is always masters. Kill the masters, fuck the masters, marry the masters. Do it all. Like, you can't get away with that in a drinking game, let alone politics. You got to make hard choices, Dany. You can't fuck, marry, and kill everyone.
That's true. It's true.
Although she is a Targaryen.
Do what she wants, I guess.
It's her hot body. She can do what she wants.
I don't know. I mean, do you think it's working? We haven't seen any more of the Sons of the Harpy.
Well, that's a very good question. Is this a smoking gun that Dario is suggesting that this is all Hisdar's doing? This is he's playing the expert game of chess here?
Could be. I mean, he was gambling with his life earlier on.
I mean, that's one of the interesting things about this whole Meereenese knot is you're, I think, supposed to constantly question.
Yeah.
Is this because she is taking a less hardline stand and is paying more respect to their culture and not, you know, fucking over the ruling class? Or is this because this is an elaborate scheme that they've engineered? Mm-hmm. Fiction as in life, it's kind of hard to tell sometimes.
Yeah, seems like
it's really, really hard to tell.
And then at the end, he leaves her with the words of wisdom that all rulers are either butchers or meat.
Great line, straight from the books.
Pretty ominous.
Yep.
Lady Olenna tries to convince the High Septon to release Loras and Margaery. When he refuses, she tries to bribe him, buy him off. He turns it down, so she goes back at him with threats, and he's unfazed, and he leaves. And then outside, Lady Olenna gets a note from Littlefinger.
I think this, you know, I feel like I'm saying this as a pattern, but I think this is kind of brilliant, is that the show is asking you, who do you believe? The Lady Olenna, who has been established as someone who is a professional at sussing out frauds and their true motives, or your own lying eyes and ears, because the High Septon is essentially accepting that. Like, yeah, I get it. You're good at this, but you've never met a true blue person.
Yeah.
Is the High Septon the only true blue person in the entire world that we've met so far, outside of Brienne? Or is he up to something, but what he wants is not something the Lady Olenna or Cersei can give him?
I get the feeling that he is actually doing what he believes.
That's frightening as well.
Sure, in a different way. But yep.
An empowered religious fanatic that just is convinced that he knows how the world should be is really scary.
Yeah, I find it interesting that, I mean, I guess he doesn't have anything on Olenna. She's kind of immune to his...
Her glory days were
before
recorded history. Those scrolls have been lost.
And she didn't do any lying to try to cover up her... her son's deeds.
Right.
I don't know. I definitely feel like he's a believer, a true believer.
Here's the thing I don't understand. Does he genuinely believe, and maybe he does as a religious fanatic. It's interesting because I just listened 2 weeks ago to the Dan Carlin's Hardcore History episode about the Anabaptist Rebellion in Munster.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And there you had a true blue believer that was getting all these signs from God, and he legitimately believed he could beat this whole army. And we know this because he strapped on armor, and him and like five of his followers went out and got,
and then got
butchered by a professional army in front of the entire city of horrified onlookers.
Yeah.
So is he that kind of, is he like a Anabaptist rebel type of figure? Or does he think that he's got some real shot at taking on the combined might of the Lannister and Tyrell forces? Because again, he's got a bunch of dudes in black robes and hammers.
So I feel like his comments at the end of this scene are telling as to what he thinks. When the many stop fearing the few. That's the scary part of him, right?
He would welcome like an over response by either the crown or
to become a martyr or something, and then enable the many to overtake the few. Like, that's where I feel his power comes from, not from any kind of physical might.
Right on.
It's the political whim of the people.
Good take. Good take.
Okay. Which is why Cersei's in such a hard spot, and Tommen is in such a hard spot. If he goes off killing people, killing the Septim, he's probably going to have issues with the people.
And they did a good job of showing that the people already have kind of turned against the
Lannisters. Yeah, shouting bastard in the streets and all this stuff.
That was back even when the Joffrey days, but apparently, you know, you got to think from a common, simple person. If you're looking on the outside and you see everything that's happened to the Baratheon rule, that, you know, the king died and then the son got there and he killed the Hand, and then they dismissed the Lord Commander of the Kingsguard, which everyone, all the common folk, really looked up to as his hero and like his bastion of integrity. It does look like the wrath of the gods are falling upon the rule of this house.
Sure.
So this is all kind of politically working out the way the Sparrow wants it to.
Now, I don't know what the penalty is in the seven-pointed star for buggery and perjury, as he puts it, but it's got to be pretty stiff, right?
There's so much Archer phrasing going on in our podcast right now.
There's nothing stiff about perjury. Come on.
We've got to stop. I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of interesting points that in the books, the buggery thing's not that big a deal.
Okay.
It's not like the abomination that sons and daughters born of incest are, for example. It's something that maybe is mildly distasteful. I don't know. But in the show, it seems like in the show universe that homosexuality is kind of like a pretty big deal.
Okay.
It's like illegal and punishable by death, you know, kind of big deal.
Yeah. All right. The other thing that's happening here that could happen, I know you want to see some kind of democratic system set up in Westeros at the end of this whole thing. Do you think that that's a possibility if the many rise against the few here? Or do you think it's going to end up as like a theocracy or something?
Well, I don't know. That's interesting because pure democracy is kind of scary, too. You have the tyranny of the majority trampling over the minority, like your homosexuals and, you know, your bastards and your people of it's. We've seen a lot of in real human history of like popular uprisings and revolts, and they're not often pretty. I think that's something I've said, I think in the spoiler edition, that I've elaborated more about my thoughts about how like the democracy, my hope for Westeros is democracy sweeps it in some form. But I think I kind of wonder if he's going with this High Sparrow deal showing that, oh, you can't just give power to the people because then you've got, you know, good, just because you're born highborn doesn't mean you're a bad person. So you get a lot of like your scholars and a lot of your leaders are put to death because people are just mad and angry about how the world is working for them. So I don't know. I mean, it's not as simple as just say, yeah, the people should take the power, because there needs to be rules and checks and balances and all of the constitution and, you know, some kind of Magna Carta type situation to limit the power, or else you get a tyranny of the majority, and that's not good either.
Yeah. All right. Marcella. Oh, no, sorry. Skipped a scene here. Tommen is pissed off that the queen is in prison. And he's pissed off that he's impotent. And instead of Tommen sending in the army, Cersei promises to talk to the High Septim for him. Can the king just take the High Septim out of power?
I think
so. Cersei appointed him. Why couldn't he just say, you're no longer the official Faith Militant?
Well, I mean, this goes back to Varys's parable of the three men with power. You know, a rich man, a king, and a septon tells a man with a sword to kill somebody. Who does he listen to? And yeah, sure. If Tommen has enough political alliances and enough swords that he can call to around his banner, he can do whatever the fuck he wants.
Yeah. Yeah, I just wonder if he could do it without upsetting the people.
Well, I mean, the open question is, what would Kevin Lannister do if he got the order to march the armies down to put down this popular rebellion? What would the Tyrells do? Mm. And who else can he call? Because, like, it's starting, I feel like that they're trying to show in the show that this is kind of like a balance, that when he first came to talk to High Septon, he could have had his Kingsguard sweep this vermin out, and it had been done.
Yeah.
The second time he went during the trial and they stole the queen, he might have to call all the gold cloaks to go in there and bust things up. He probably could have got it done. Now he's talking about open war. I wonder, like, if every episode is this, you know, Sparrow's power seems to grow and his grip gets tighter on the city. I wonder if there's anything to be done with it by the end here, by whatever end game we're going to.
Yeah, I mean, Cersei has a fair point in this scene about who the first casualty of that war would be.
Right. It's Marge, which is a bummer if you're Tommen.
Sure. And now it's an extra bummer, right? Because you say what you want about Cersei, but Tommen definitely loves his mother. So now that they have two pawns, two potential sacrificial people here, that's even more dangerous for Tommen if he decides to declare this war.
Sure. And Tommen, I like Tommen. I think he's a good boy. And if Tywin had lived long enough to mold him into a good leader, it'd have been interesting. But he's just a boy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if he goes to a small council and because his mom's gone now, if he goes to a small council and says, now what? He's got Grand Maester Pycelle, who is an idiot, and Qyburn, who is one...
Just send the mountain in,
is a pointed hat away from being a full-on warlock. I mean, this is not great. Like, I can't believe I'm saying this, but I wish Mace Tyrell were around.
Mm, yeah.
To give some advice, to make a couple of lame jokes, because that's better than what he's going to get from his small council.
You think we see Mace by the end of this season again?
My money
either
is on
him,
yes.
Him or his body, one of the two.
My money is on yes.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Because he is, you know, he's another piece of this puzzle. As ineffective as I think he would be in anything he tries to do, he is still part of that family.
And he's he is in name the head of the family.
Yeah, he does kind of hold the keys to the Lannister kingdom in a way.
Sure.
He's more powerful than he looks, we'll say that.
Right.
So Marcella comes to see Jaime, and they argue about whether she should come home. She tells him, nope, I'm staying in Dorne. I like it here. You guys sent me away. What do you expect?
How she starts off with, why aren't you blonde? Where's your hand? And Jaime somehow resists, like, bitch, you were recast since last we saw you. Don't talk to me about character changes.
Was she?
She was different. And it seemed like the old Marcella was a real sweetheart about it, because she did this vine when Joffrey died, and she said she was wearing a tiara with a sign that says, I'm ready. And then when she found out she was recast, she had a vine where she's sitting on the sidewalk with, like, you know, we'll act for food. So
nice.
And I'm not even sure why they replaced her. Replaced a generically pretty blonde with another generically pretty blonde that's approximately the same age.
Weird.
Like, I don't know if her agent big timed.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, we do realize we've replaced a mountain three times. And he's a hell of a lot more memorable than Princess Marcella. You sobbed on a boat. That's how people know you. I don't know. But I wonder if there was a little bit of, like, ribbing at the fans about her calling in question how much he's changed when she's a completely different person.
Could be. I got to say, though, if they ever do another Super Mario Brothers movie, she needs to play Princess Peach.
She's
looking exactly like her.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just put a tiara on her head. Boom.
Yeah. She needs an Italian plumber in her life. What?
All right.
So the other thing I want to talk about this scene is she says, this has been my home for years.
Mm-hmm.
This feels like a really fucked up timeline. Like, there is, on the one hand, some of this stuff is supposed to have taken place, it feels like, fairly quickly. But on the other hand, she is here. Like, for example, I'll tell you why it's fucked up. Gilly had her baby in season 2. Marcella was shipped off to Dorne in season 2.
Okay.
Dorne has been her home for several years. This baby is still, like, 6 months old.
Uh-huh.
There is some, like, I don't know if there's a supermassive black hole underneath the wall and, like, time is going much slower down there.
Uh-huh.
There's some Matthew McConaughey interstellar bullshit happening, but the timeline is a fucking mess. It is really
Sam's
a mess.
Books are going to start moving.
Yeah, like, Rick's coma in The Walking Dead has nothing on the chronological mishaps going on here.
I don't know, man. I know they play a little bit with time, but not that much.
Yeah.
As far as I can tell.
Yeah. And I was just, you know, kind of expecting, like, okay, well, you know, we've got this kind of fuzzy grasp on math and time. And I know that's, you know, it's something we talk in Breaking Bad, how, like, you know, the whole series takes place in this roughly the span of 18 months, but it feels like it's been years because that's how we're watching real time. But there is a little bit of a problem here.
Yeah. I mean, she's a kid. Maybe she just feels like it's been forever. You know?
It's been a long summer. So,
yeah. Summers used to last forever.
That's
when you're
thing.
A kid, man.
That's the thing I've often wondered, and I've never gotten a satisfying solution. How do they keep track of years in Westeros?
When I don't
summers
know.
And seasons are variable length and can last for literal years, like I'm assuming they have some kind of celestial way of marking events, but you know, weird.
Yeah.
Like what kind of fucked up calendar do you use?
I don't know. The Dornish calendar.
There you go. It's always summer in Dorne, apparently.
I think so, yeah.
It's like always sunny in Pennsylvania. Wait, shit.
Philadelphia.
Philadelphia, thank you.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, the very special isn't your speed. We've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
All right, before we move on, I want to talk to you briefly, Aaron, about some old Valyrian technology that may have been lost.
You've been paying attention
Dragon
to
War.
My lore lessons, then.
I have been, yeah. One of those things, if I'm not mistaken, was the ability to easily and quickly create websites without any coding, right?
Oh, yeah, sure. That technology has been lost for centuries. Just a few masters are left alive that can successfully reforge the bits of HTML and CSS in any kind of successful format.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a harsh world out there, too. I mean, you look at guys like Davos. How's Davos supposed to make a website if he has to code it by hand? It's going to take him forever.
He doesn't have any fingers on one of them.
I know, man.
He's fighting with one hand tied behind the keyboard.
Now imagine if he could do it all with a mouse.
Ooh.
And some fancy tools, right?
Hmm.
He could probably make his own website. What I'm saying is, Squarespace has rediscovered this old Valyrian technology, the ability to easily and quickly create professional-looking websites that anyone can do, even Davos.
All he needs is one hand, a mouse, and an onion.
Exactly.
You might not even need the onion. That's how easy it is.
It's pretty easy. You don't even need a credit card.
What?
That's how easy it is. You can go to the site. You can sign up right now for a free trial. No credit card required. Check it out for 14 days. See if you like it. If you do like it, it's $8 a month, and it comes with a free domain if you sign up for a year. And you can get 10% off by using our offer code GOT.
Mm.
How does that strike you?
It strikes me pretty good. I know there's a lot of people out there who have been wanting to start a Game of Thrones blog or a podcast.
There you go.
Or maybe even a company that could actually make money. Don't start a podcast if you want to make money.
Oh yeah, we can vouch for that. but yeah, they make it super easy. I tested it out, and as a guy who makes websites for a living at one point in his life, this is way easier. Way, way easier. So check it out. Go use the offer code GOT. Get 10% off your first order. All right. Where are we? Bronn. We go to Bronn singing the Dornishman's wife in his cell. No one but, I think her name is Tyene. I don't know how you say that. No one but her is amused.
You got Obara and then the other two. I'm not sure which.
Obara, Nim, one of them
Nymeria
is...
Nymeria and Tyrina?
I don't know how to say it. Anyway, she strips for Braun, which causes the poison in his blood to go to his head. And when he collapses, she gives him the antidote. This is a scene I have a problem with.
Sure.
And I don't have the same problem that the internet's having with the, you know, her using her sexuality as a weapon and whether or not that's empowering, like all this stuff.
Sure.
My problem is just purely from a plot standpoint.
It seems dumb.
Telling us in the same fucking scene as he's cured that he's poisoned serves what purpose?
I mean, we have some interesting...
We don't have time to worry about Braun's health.
We have some interesting emails about what this is going to be, you know, that made some alternative takes. But yeah, it stuck out. I mean, I've always defended the show's sex position because, like, if Littlefinger's giving a long monologue about how he came to power in his boyhood, throw some tits and ass in there. Why not? Why not make it visually interesting? This, we didn't learn anything new about these characters. And there was, as you say, there was no real danger to Braun because he either lives and dies, and that was resolved in the scene. So I guess it was a give us a scene to like get to know the Sand Snakes better since they've been kind of underdeveloped.
Yeah, I think it shows a dynamic between the three of them a little bit where Tyene is you can see them rolling their eyes, the other two rolling their eyes when she starts this.
Right.
Like, oh, here she goes again. This old trick. So I think it gives a little characterization to their relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I mean, for as much as is made about Oberyn, we haven't seen a lot of the other Dornish people being hypersexual, you know?
Yeah,
and there's whole society really being about that. And I feel like this helped that along a little bit.
I mean, that's true. Like, these are Oberyn's daughters. Oberyn famously invited Tywin to an orgy. It's kind of a piece for that. But by the time we got to that scene... we took Oberyn serious as a character. Because even during his introduction during the whorehouse, he also almost killed two Lannister guards effortlessly.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas these three struggled to put away 1.5 dudes.
Yeah.
It just nothing, like they haven't done anything to merit what the show thinks we should feel about them.
I think you're right.
It could be the double D's like, well, Oberyn is a badass. These are his daughters. Mm-hmm. So the audience is just going to buy that they're badasses. I don't know that it's true.
Yeah, I haven't seen much that tells me they're that amazing.
Right.
I do get the distinct feeling that they want me to think that, though.
Right. Like, every time else we're introduced to a badass, they do something really badass, like, within moments of doing it. And I'm talking men and women.
Mm-hmm.
And here we're just, like, it's all trading on the name.
Yeah.
So, I buy Obara. She seems to be the one of all of them, like, you know, she actually did something. She speared a dude's head with her spear. I mean, that's some skill involved. The others, like, you know, you got the whip and the dagger, and I haven't been impressed with the way they used them.
Okay.
So there you go.
Yeah, I'm with you. This show has got a thing for necklaces, yeah?
Sure.
Poisons, antidotes, there's all sorts of shit stored in necklaces.
But that's kind of realistic, like... you know, hollow rings and stuff like that. In the days where poison was a major concern for people, a lot of times they did have. And that makes sense. If you're going to use a deadly poison that could kill you on your fucking blade where you might get that introduced in some blood of your own, hell yeah, you'll carry the antidote.
Sure. On you? Certainly.
So, like, there are some people have logic. It's like, why would you carry an antidote? It's like, why wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Why would you not, like, you run around with the rage virus and if you don't have an antidote, you're an idiot.
It's like, I don't know. It's like... doing an experiment with fire and not having a fire extinguisher at hand. What the fuck are you doing?
Unless you're Targaryen, and then it's like, cool.
Sure, well, we know they're fireproof.
Although, point of fact, Aemon Targaryen burnt like a piece of dry kindling.
That's true. It's true. He doesn't have enough dragon blood. All right, Littlefinger surveys the damage to his ransacked brothel. Lady Olenna tells him that their fates are joined together by killing the king, and he promises that he's working with her, and tells her that he has a gift for her after she kind of threatens him.
Yeah.
Not even kind of. She just outright says, hey, if I go down, you're going down too.
Totally missing the instant cast after seeing it once and talking about it 5 minutes later. We totally missed the fact that this is the other gift. The gift is Tyrion, but he also says specifically, I have a gift to the same one I gave Cersei, a handsome young man.
Yeah, who's the handsome young man? I'm trying to...
There's a lot of...
I feel like I should know that, but...
You know what? I thought it was just going to be like, well, he's going to have... what's his face?
Loras.
Oliver.
Oh, I thought he was saying, like, I'm going to have Loras released somehow.
No, I thought that he was going to have Oliver killed.
Okay.
And I still think that that's probably a likely scenario.
I mean, that would be... And, you know, she would probably enjoy that, but I don't know that that helps her.
Why doesn't it? If the only witness to the crime is dead and can no longer give testimony.
I guess. It felt like, to me, the damage was done already.
Yeah, like the Sparrow's like, well, the guy's dead. What are we going to do?
I don't think that would stand.
Yeah.
They'd just be like, he gave testimony during the original trial.
But on my first and second watch, but there has been some compelling stuff sent in through the listeners. We'll get to in the feedback section.
Okay, cool.
Don't want to step on their toes.
He also has some information, some other information that Cersei is unaware of. I don't know what that is either.
I think it's connected to the handsome young man. Like, whatever information.
Okay, I could see that.
Or it could be, like, so the popular theories are, it could be Lancel, and that he somehow, the way that it reads at the end, I don't think that Lancel has turned any new evidence. This is stuff that the High Sparrow has been sitting on this whole time.
Oh, yeah.
Dealing with Cersei.
Yeah, definitely.
Which really is interesting, puts a context into earlier scenes. That he's been a spider, just waiting for her to keep blundering further and further into his web, and now it's too late when she finally tries to get out.
Yeah, and it feels like he's trying to get as much accomplished as he can, and if he takes out Cersei right away, that may cause more of a problem.
Sure.
Than picking off some of the Tyrells first.
Sure.
Anyway, Jorah prepares to compete in the Great Games qualifiers. Dany's there, and she is disturbed by the killing. Until Jorah comes out, disables everybody without killing anyone. And then Dany, when he takes his helmet off, is not happy to see him. But Tyrion comes out and says, I am the gift from Jorah. My name's Tyrion Lannister. And dramatic end to the episode.
Dany has no whether to shit and or go blind.
Yeah, preferably both.
I got to call some bullshit on his Dar's tradition talk.
Why?
He could tell her anything.
Sure.
Your Grace, it's tradition among the old Giscari Empire that the king gets a blowjob upon every morning on waking up.
Sure.
What? This doesn't say it's tradition. Riots in the streets.
You don't want to upset the will of the people.
No. Am I not a wise master? Like, come on now. Come on.
Yeah. No. I don't know. You can see the smile on his face, too, which is interesting.
Mm.
Like, he's having the very opposite reaction of what she's having.
Mm.
Ah. I don't know.
See, I thought
man.
He
this
played
tenuous.
That pretty close to the vest about whether he enjoyed this or not. You thought he enjoyed
it? There's one scene, where he's kind of off to the side and you can see a big smile on his face. Whether that's intentional or not, I don't know.
Okay.
But the rest of the time, he's kind of trying to look real dour or whatever.
I feel like this show is starting to get a little sloppy and stuff. For instance, why does Jorah have a big honking gold ring?
He's a slave, they give all their slaves gold rings.
Well, they essentially strip everything of value from, he's not fighting in his plate armor. He doesn't have his nice sword, but they let him keep that big honking ring and all of his bauble. Like, that's stupid.
Yeah.
That's really dumb, and it sticks out on multiple viewings. It's like, why? I feel like the costume people, that was a big miss for them.
Yeah,
he should be stripped of everything that he had of value.
Probably right.
The other thing, why was Tyrion chained up? No one else was chained up. The door's locked. Tyrion is the only one that chained up.
I don't know, man. I really don't know.
That makes no sense.
It doesn't. Because they don't escort Jorah out there.
Right.
They leave him unchained, all alone.
I think that there's a compelling post on the internet that claimed that the big fat dude that freed Tyrion... Which you could say that Tyrion, one of his skills is he's a fat, dumb jailer whisperer. Like he's got a special mystical juju hold over fat, dumb jailers in the series. But some people said that that's supposed to be a nod to his book readers of this kind of fan favorite character that has been written out of the show called Strong Belwas, who is described as this like fat, strong dude with a big curved Arrak blade like the Dothraki use.
Okay.
So maybe that was just kind of like a wink to us book readers. Like,
yeah.
Here's your character. Wave to him bye as we'll never see him again.
Yeah, probably.
Also, thought it was interesting that we haven't seen this in forever, but one of Dany's honor guardians was a Dothraki.
Yeah, yeah, I noticed that.
Uh-huh.
They show it real quick, like one time.
Yeah.
Like they had almost I haven't seen a Dothraki in ages.
Yeah, really, since the end of season two where her household got cleaned out. We haven't seen them.
Yeah, they're so apparently they're still around. Hanging around.
I thought that was mildly interesting.
They don't have a say in the council. What the fuck?
Exactly. The fucking horse riders make it. This is bullshit.
Yeah.
Mother of lies, more like it.
So,
what did you think of the action? Because there's some people saying it's just kind of bullshit, but...
It was fine.
I like Jorah going full-on Batman, like just beating him down with the fist because he knows that's what Danny would like.
I do, too. I mean, one guy, I don't know if he gets the wind knocked out of him or what, he gets punched in the solar plexus and goes down and stays down for a good five. I don't know.
These are slaves. I mean...
Okay.
That's the thing. Like, probably less than half of them want to be here or are excited about the prospect of dying. So, somebody gives you a solid punch to solar plexus and nobody's... coming around, you just play dead. Play dead. You can always recuperate in the holding cell.
True.
The other thing is, like, yeah, like, the whole only free men allowed to fight. I don't know what the Westerosi version of the slave card is, like, to check the summon status, but this seemed really fishy. Like, and Danny's only concern was men were dying. Not like, are these free? Like, if she's that bothered about it, you'd think she'd like, can I see some documentation? Can I talk to their coach / slave master? Can, you know, she's curiously incurious about the history and background of these men.
Yeah, I'm with you. It's a little strange.
And is that another evidence about Hisdar being a villain? Because somebody knows the guys booking this fight know that these are free, not free men, they're slaves.
Yeah.
Somebody within, like, how many degrees of separation from Hisdar has to know with absolute fact that these are actually slaves? That's what I'm thinking, too.
Yeah, there might be one guy between him and the slaves.
Yeah, the guy that booked it and runs the thing and goes, oh, yeah, you should come. We're having a fight. Bring the queen. It's tradition. You know? What is Hisdar's game, man? What's he playing at?
I feel like he might be playing a long con to get the masters back in power. You know, get her to give up just enough to where she makes a mistake and she can't take it back. Kind of like Cersei. The other question I have is, was Jorah supposed to be in this fight? Technically, he won the qualifier, right? He went around, he kicked everybody's ass.
I feel like he was supposed to be round two. Like, you got the first round, and there's going to be, like...
But, like, everybody left.
Yeah.
It was just him and Tyrion left in there.
No. There were several dudes that followed him out after he pushed the door open. Now, they
didn't seem
like they went to the battlefield. It seemed like they're like, fuck this, I'm out of here.
Yeah.
But, yeah, no, there was... It felt... You know, I've seen Gladiator before. Like, you've got several rounds.
Sure.
I've been to a demolition derby at the county fair. I know what this...
Well, you want to spread the killing out.
Yeah.
Make a day of it.
Yeah, it might seem entertaining to have all 100 cars in the mud pit at once, but then you blew your load and 15 minutes later, no one's buying elephant ears and roasted peanuts anymore.
Sure, that's why. I mean, they do that every time. That's why they can't afford a better stadium.
It's a poorly run slave killing.
Really, yeah.
Entertainment show.
Sure. I just wonder if, like, what she's going to do with Jorah here. She's got Jorah.
She did not give a fuck.
She wants to throw back in the prisons.
Did you find that shocking? That, like, the Myrcella type years have passed and has not made her judgment any less harsh. I mean, she's just like, get him out of my sight.
I didn't find it all that surprising. I felt like it was justified.
I feel like
she's
really
still pissed. Nothing has changed.
How she feels about him.
Okay.
Because, like, you know, if she'd wondered about him or thought about him at all, I think her first reaction would be a little bit more mixed.
Yeah.
But it was in sins. Get him out of my sight.
Mm-hmm.
So not great for Jorah there.
Yeah, I mean, we speculated a little bit about what happens with Jorah and Tyrion in the instant cast. Maybe Tyrion can talk himself into position. Maybe Jorah will get one as well.
Do you still feel like after second watches, do you feel like this is a zero-sum game or there is a way that Tyrion can spin this that they both get to live.
Man, I would not put anything past Tyrion at this point as far as talking people into things.
He's got to be careful because if he tells too many lies, like if he's like, no, really what's happened on small councils, Jorah was our real inside man and like Barristan wasn't privy to these high level communications. Like, I don't think he can play that. He's got to find a way to put Jorah's crimes into context that Danny would understand. And I don't, I'm struggling to see how that would happen.
Yeah. Yeah. That'll be tough. I wonder if Jorah is, if Hisdar might insist that maybe Jorah be let into the Great Games.
What good does that do Jorah?
It doesn't do him any good.
I was going to say.
Sure, but it would give us an awesome scene of Jorah fighting in the Great Games, like in a proper fucking Coliseum.
Do you think we're going to get a proper fucking Coliseum?
I want one. I desperately want one.
Okay. Because that's the other thing. I'm not really sure why they staged this in this little, you know, backwater arena.
I mean, like you said on the Instacat, it does make sense, you know, it's just a qualifier. But man, I want that scene. I want a big Roman Coliseum type gladiator scene.
Yeah. Do you think there'll be slaves fighting in the Great Pit of Draznak or whatever? Or do you think that those will all be the big games? Or do you think those will all be freemen?
Well, what do you consider freemen? Jorah is, all of these guys were ostensibly freemen, right?
No, but they were sold into slavery. They had to fight. They had no choice.
Danny thinks that all of them the line is so blurred I don't know.
If we go up to the Great Games and they're still slave fighting, then what does that tell us about Hisdar? He's openly subverting her, the rule of his queen, right?
And will she catch on at that
because
point?
Because he has to know, like, if he get, okay, maybe he doesn't, not, he doesn't, this is like Walmart not understanding that child labor is being used and producing their sweat. Oh, we subcontracted out this other reputable place that then fucked us over. We had no knowledge. It gets harder to believe, like, if you invade the Bentonville, Arkansas t-shirt factory and it's nothing but five-year-old Indian girls, it gets harder to believe that, like, you didn't know anything about that.
Yeah, the
I'm willing
time
to
it
believe
happens.
That maybe Hisdar just didn't know. He's a young guy himself. Dad got killed. He wasn't ready to take the reins of the family. You get to the Great Games and there's slave fighting. That's some skullduggery, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think Hisdar knows. So certainly if he knows, he will know, in my opinion, in the Great Games. And maybe he'll get found out.
Sure enough.
Final scene. Cersei goes to see Marjorie so she can rub her defeat in her face. Marjorie's in terrible shape. Pleased with herself, Cersei goes to ask the High Septim about the trial. He delivers some monologue about vanity. Then Loras shows up, you know.
Right.
Lancel shows up, having told the Septim what he knows about Cersei, and they grab her and throw her in the dungeons.
Yeah. There's a couple interesting things. I thought that it was interesting that Cersei, on the way out of seeing Marjorie, drops her handkerchief, which is kind of like a traditional symbol of a damsel in distress.
Huh, I didn't even see that.
Yeah, because she had that hanky that was covered in venison, which I thought that was fun too. It's like, I brought you this food that I ate last night. It's probably
Here's
kind of vaguely spoiled leftovers. We got no refrigeration.
Yeah.
That was lost in the recipe that had Valyrian steel in. But I thought that was interesting. And also the Septon droning on about the sturdy and real versus gilded monstrosities. Like, he's got this casual contempt of Baelor, which it'd be like hearing someone talk shit about the Apostle Paul. Like, Baelor is a beloved person of everyone. He is like one of the big names in the Faith of the Seven. And it's interesting to hear him basically talk shit about him. It really, for me as a book reader, crystallizes his fanaticism.
So yeah, I didn't get that, having only seen the show.
Sure. I don't know. I love the look in her face. Like, you know, Lena knocked it out of the park. The whole, you know, kind of like, Arya, what? What's going on?
Keep smiling.
Yeah. It's too late.
Shit's about to go down. I need to extricate myself.
You know, I thought it was a missed opportunity. You remember when they cut off Jamie's hand and they smash cut to, like, the pop rock version of the Bear, the Maiden Fair. I wish they'd smashed cut to a pop version of Jeremy Flynn singing The Dornishman's Wife right after she gets thrown in the cell. Like, some upbeat, jaunty, happy. You know, that would have been fun. That'd have been fun. What's all this dour, like, or like an ironic Reigns of Castamere, like, played on a kazoo? That would have been fun too.
All right, I like it.
We got the lion laid low, and we got some mournful music. Fuck that shit.
Yeah, it's something we've all been waiting for, right?
Yeah, man.
I It's weird. It's weird how they twist me up like this in this show. I have been waiting for Cersei to get some kind of righteous retribution for a very long time. I'm disappointed that it was this High Septim guy, because I hate him almost as much as I hate Cersei.
Mm-hmm.
I don't... religious fanaticism is not something I appreciate.
Mm-hmm.
Even when it is executed on people who I don't like.
Right.
I think that's a fairly consistent stance to take. Tommen certainly doesn't deserve all the shit he's being put through.
Right.
Like, what does Margaery deserve?
Right.
None of that shit.
Sure.
So seeing Cersei was kind of bittersweet, you know?
Yeah.
For me. It was definitely more sweet than it was bitter.
Sure, sure.
Let's not mix words here, but...
And she... Tom, if he's going to be any man at all, he has to escape the gravitational pull of Cersei.
Well, there you go.
So even if he's temporarily unhappy about it,
mm-hmm.
you know, long term, it's the good move for him.
Yeah, and I'm eagerly awaiting the time when Tommen decides, you know what, war is the preferred alternative here.
Hmm.
Let's call in the army. What does he do? Does he call his uncle? Does he call Kevin up?
I have no
idea.
Yo,
Kevin, I need your armies. We got a situation here.
I have no idea what the next step is.
Okay. So, I think he's going to be pissed, though.
Sure.
Yeah.
You know, you saw this impetuous 14-year-old wanting to bring down death and destruction just when they kidnapped his wife. Well, now that they got the mother in there, too. I also thought it was really great her, you know, screaming about being the queen. When
sure,
you know,
the exact made, same thing happened.
They've made
with
for a season and a half now the point that you are not the queen. You're some queen,
yes.
regent, mother, has been hag bullshit.
Yeah,
but you're not the queen, and that. But that's how she sees herself.
Oh yeah.
So I thought that was pretty good.
And that's it.
Also, just so I don't get a million emails, you keep calling him the High Septim. That is the thing you pierce in your nose. It's the High Septon.
Oh.
And it'd be especially annoying since you don't get any of these emails. So fuck
me.
If I'm going to get it's one thing to get taken to task on my own bullshit, but I'm not taking it for you, man.
All right.
I'm not taking it for you.
Fair enough.
So stand, delete those drafts you've got going already.
All right. So at the end of this, I'm going to play us out with I've Tasted the Dornishman's Bride.
Wife.
That's the name of the song, yes.
Wife.
Send your emails to a.ron.
The Cornish hens. The Cornish hens, paramour. Sure,
yep.
Yeah. Why not? So as I mentioned in the main podcast proper, I got a special treat for our Audible ad this week. And first off, you can go to audiblepodcast.com/GOT to get a free audiobook for trying out Audible services and being a patron of baldmove.com. Since I started doing this, I got a lot of people saying, hey, Ron, you got to play one of George Martin's sex scenes. And I'm like, okay. Mm. But I've had this scene because I figured we'd get around to it. I had this scene in my back pocket. It's the apex of George Martin's sex scenes. It happened right here in the episode. And I want to show you the scene as it unfolds out in its splendor. It's beautiful dance of love and mystery and romance as written down by the great George Martin. Jim, play the clip.
And he could taste the rum on Jilly's tongue. And the next thing, her breasts were bare, and he was touching them. I said the words, Sam thought again. But one of her nipples found its way between his lips. It was pink and hard, and when he sucked on it, the milk filled his mouth, mingled with a taste of rum, and he had never tasted anything so fine and sweet and good. And suddenly, his cock was out, jutting upward from his breeches like a fat pink mast. It looked so silly standing there that he might have laughed. But Jilly pushed him back onto her pallet, hiked her skirts up around her thighs, and lowered herself onto him with a little whimpery sound. That was even better than her nipples. Oh, she's so wet, he thought, gasping. I never knew a woman could get so wet down there.
So how'd you like that, Jim?
That's ridiculous. Completely, thoroughly ridiculous.
On the positive, Sam invented rum chata. Didn't even know.
Oh, I mean, God.
His contribution to the art of mixed drink echoes down through the ages.
The cinnamon wind.
Sure.
The milky rum-laden goodness.
Yeah. So if you want to find out the softer side of Game of Thrones, if you want to know your Mira swamps from your fat pink mast, your lord's kiss from your Dornishman's wife, the only way to do that is to read the books. And Audible gives you a great way to do so, featuring the complete unabridged works of George Martin. How do you know it's unabridged? Ask yourself, would the great Roy Daughtry say the words fat pink mast if he didn't have to? Hell no, that's the power of unabridged, people. And it all supports WhisperSync technology, so you can read on your Kindle and then seamlessly move to your car or your cell phone when you're out on your jog, your bicycle ride, and have old Roy read to you. Not only can you get the works of Martin, but 185,000 other volumes of spoken word content. The best part is you get a free trial just by going to audiblepodcast.com/GOT. That's right. You get any one audiobook free just for giving them a shot. I'm a huge fan of their service personally. Can't recommend them enough. And we thank them for sponsoring our podcast.
Yeah, let's get to feedback.
Feedback. We got Win H says, think you all are missing out on the real reason why Lady Olenna can't retaliate against Cersei and out the incest love child at Tommen. Though his lineage is loosely known as spoken truth, it would damage the Tyrell status, specifically by nullifying Margaery's queen status. If Tommen's not king, then Margaery's not queen. I think she probably calculated Ser Loras has a better chance of release by having Queen Margaery lobby the king than to blow it all up. Yeah, so that's
fair.
Something we missed in the last podcast. I think we might have talked about it in the instant, but I wanted to give credit where credit's due.
Cool.
Moving on to Matt S. said, I thought this episode is better overall than last week's, but damn it, if Dorne isn't still awful. I don't understand the purpose of the Sand Snake stripping down for Bronn. Whereas the much-debated Sansa rape scene, in my opinion, served a narrative purpose, I do not see one in having an already defeated warrior defeated once more by sexual desires. What was the Sand Snake's motivation? What was the Double D's motivation in writing that scene? Why poison Bronn just to give him the antidote? And damn it, why is Julian Bashir locked up in Odo's prison cell? Yeah, why?
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about it. I agree. I agree completely.
Prince Doran is now the interesting thing about Dorne.
Yes.
And we are going on 8 episodes into this season, and all he's done is look at a young couple and say we need to protect them and do kind of a below average job of doing that.
Yeah. No, it's a shame.
I'm kind of shocked so that we've gotten this far and he has been nothing but a gouty dude on a wheelchair that pisses and moans about not being able to do things for Dorne.
Yeah, I don't know if they're going to come back around to him and he be a major player in the story, but I hope so. I like the actor. I like the character so far.
Candace W. says, how awesome would it have been if Aemon Targaryen's body had been fireproof and survived the funeral pyre? Would you have enjoyed that, Jim? Or is it got the bacony stink of magic all over it?
Well, of course, but I don't know. Like, I don't know how Dany is special. I don't know how this guy should have reacted to fire. Like, I think it might have been cool. Yeah.
Maybe he was a witch if he didn't burn. There's always that.
Mm.
Usanu A, my new favorite word name to pronounce, says, I don't know what to think about Hisdar anymore. I first thought that he was clearly the one behind the Sons of the Harpy. However, after Dario points out this to Dany, I am not so sure anymore. It now seems just too obvious for the show to reveal that Hisdar is, in fact, the main antagonist. Damn it, Dario. You're muddying the waters, man.
Yeah, except Dany doesn't believe him, right? So are we as the audience also not supposed to believe him?
I just, you know, mild interest. Don't know.
Hiding in plain sight, that Hisdar is.
He's like a gecko. I'm not. He's going to sell us car insurance next. I'm not so sure that Littlefinger was talking about Lansa Lannister, Lady Olenna. By the way, the High Sparrow is speaking to Cersei. It seems as though Lancel's confession to him was prior to Olenna and It seems as though Lancel's confession to him was prior to Olenna and Littlefinger's conversation. I think there's a good chance that he could be talking about Gendry instead. After all, who could be a better witness to reveal all of Cersei's sins than a bastard of King Robert, who looks nothing like Cersei's children, and who also knows the atrocities that she and her son committed to cover up the rumors about her and Jaime? We were just talking about not seeing Gendry is last seen rowing frantically from Dragonstone to Westeros. We haven't seen him since. He qualifies as a handsome young man, and he does have all these things that he could dish on the Lannisters. Have we cracked the code? Do you think?
Possibly.
My money's still on Olivar. But
okay,
if Gendry doesn't show up before this tale is told, it'll be a really weird detour. One of many,
yeah, I think you're
be
right.
Fair in the books, but I'm kind of surprised that they would keep it in the show if it was truly a dead mm-hmm. end.
Yeah.
Nathan P wants to play the name game with us on the gift. He says, one, the gift that Jorah gives Dany of Tyrion. Littlefinger gives up Lancel to Olenna and the Sparrows for his testimony. Big assumption on your part there, Nathan.
Yeah, that's assuming a lot.
As we just uncovered. Olenna tries to give the High Sparrow wealth, power, and luxury as gifts, but he refuses it. Bronn gets given a cure, as well as a little something-something extra. The Sand Snakes get given a scene where I don't hate them.
Okay.
Sansa gives Theon a candle. Theon gives it to Ramsay. Ramsay gives Sansa a threat in the form of a flayed supporter. That's stretching the bounds of gifts a little.
Yeah, I mean, does a gift have to be a positive thing?
I guess that's true. Like, if death is a gift in this world, then no, I would say not.
Okay.
I'm going to give you the gift of a kick in the balls, Jim. I expect a thank you note. Sam gives John a dragonglass dagger. Certainly.
There you go.
Qualifies as gift.
Bringing it back around.
Gilly gives Sam a quote-unquote reward. And the showrunners give the audience a gift by finally having Cersei locked up.
I don't view that as a reward. I don't think she was rewarding him for saving her. I think she was, when he says, look, I'm going to protect you and little Sam no matter what, they've established a really solid relationship between the two of them. And she's not rewarding him. She's just doing what she felt was natural because of the relationship.
She's sharing the gift of sexuality between two people in love.
Yeah, I really felt like it was based totally on the relationship they have, not on...
That's the sexy ideal, right? Two people that love each other, and they get together, and they bump uglies.
Well, unless you're in a jail cell across from a sand snake, then that's the sexy ideal.
I don't think there's anything sexy or ideal about that situation. But I did have a little bit... The second time I watched this, I had a little bit of darker take, because I started thinking about Gilly's history, and how she was one of many Craster's sister wives, and they... obviously endured all kinds of abuse at his hands. And it makes me wonder how she sees Sam. Like, I know how Sam sees Gilly, and it's been pretty consistent. But her, she's always been a lot more complex because she's been through a lot more shit. She's been through a lot more experiences than Sam. And I kind of do wonder what exactly is the nature of her feelings for him. I'm not saying any of them are bad or weird, but I think there is a little bit, I don't know whether she's in love or whether she is grateful or whether she says, like, well, this is what you do when someone does, you know, provides you food or protection. There's a lot, again, it's a dark take on it, but I think there's a little bit there with her history with Craster and all that fuckery up there.
Sure, there's a lot there.
Dominic T said, I figured the Sand Snake antidote scene was going to get some groans, but I'm okay with it for the following reason. If Bronn dies in a cell next to them, what does it do to help their cause? Nothing. He's no longer a threat, so why let him die? She has to assume that he is a Westerosi knight, which he is, although she doesn't know he's an up-jumped one. She's assuming he's a knight, so you'd think that he would show a sense of appreciation and or loyalty to a foe that would show mercy. Now, he's not only... no longer a foe, but potentially he's an ally. As far as the banter between them, she is still a child. If she had Oberyn's swagger as well as his blood, it would have come off more convincingly. Alaria may have pulled it off, but not a child still learning. Do you think that there's anything to his theory? Actually, let's go on to the next one, because they're kind of tied together. Frank S. said, I agree with you that the sex scene between Bronn and Sand Snakes in Dornish Dungeons is odd and inexplicable. Was it just another opportunity for a boob shot? Maybe, but the scene would make sense if this was showing Bronn being co-opted by the Sand Snakes. Did Bronn take a permanent antidote, or was it only a temporary cure that he'll have to take again and again to stay alive? While Bronn does seem to have turned out to be a stand-up guy with some real loyalty to the Lannisters, ultimately he is a sellsword and loyal only to himself. If his choice ends up being between A, staying true to Jaime, and possibly becoming a rich man, and B, survival and betraying Jaime, wouldn't he have to choose the latter? Do you think that this is all a very long con of the Sand Snakes trying to get Bronn's allegiance or affection for some other purpose down the line?
It could be. It could be. I don't know. I mean, I'm trying to think. Their goal is to get Myrcella to start this war. How would Bronn help them in that? I mean, having one
other... Well, if he has to take the antidote... you know, once a day, every day. I mean, the weakness of that plan is they're stuck in jail. How are they going to get more antidote?
Sure.
Maybe she's got beads in other places that jailers don't check. I don't know.
No, I'm going to throw that theory out the window. I don't think it's a daily ritual. He's got to, I don't think he's got diabetes now. He's got to inject himself with insulin.
And if it's the other theory that, well, he's a Westerosi knight, so he values, well, she doesn't know this, but we know Bronn doesn't give a shit.
Sure.
So if she's going to try that, I think she's going to be disappointed.
Yeah. I suppose that could be the plan, but, and it makes the scene a little bit more interesting, but I don't know to what end.
But I hope it comes out to be more than just her kind of flirting with him. Although, Dominic has a point that, yes, you poison your blade so it's more effective. But mm-hmm. in this situation, there's no need to let him die in the cell next to you. Like, the poison can't serve the purpose it was originally designed to do. Although, the other question, if you're in a daring daylight raid on a prison, why the hell do you coat your blade with the long goodbye?
That seems like an assassination technique, not...
Yeah,
not a fighting style.
You would want the fucking kill him right there poison.
Yeah.
You want the strangler. You want the heart ripper. You want the five-step heart stopper of death. You don't want the long kiss goodbye.
Sure.
Which might be more evidence that the Sand Snakes are a bunch of fucking idiots. I don't know. Scott V says, I'm a show watcher, not a book reader. So can you explain winter to me? I mean, I know it can last for years. I assume every winter the White Walkers attack the Wall. So how long has it been since last winter? 50 years? 500 years? At least long enough that everyone thinks the White Walkers aren't real, right? How far does winter extend? Does it cover the world? Are there landmasses here that are safe? Or is it magic and covers everywhere? Do people fear it just because it lasts for years and you can't grow crops during it? If you guys could have a discussion that covers these questions, that would be great. Thank you.
Thought we discussed this a little bit before.
I think we were going to, and then we forgot. But just in case, real briefly, no, the White Walkers don't attack every time that the winter comes. They are kind of, there's been many winters. I did some research, and it seems that there was a spring, that spring sprung just about the time of the birth of, like, Jon Snow and Robb Stark. So it's been 16 to 20 years since the last winter, and there's been an unusually long summer, an unusually mild summer, which some people believe is going to predict, just as is now, if you read the Farmer's Almanac, that you're going to have a correspondingly bad winter. And mostly, it feels like that the winters are confined to the north. Like even at King's Landing, it will get cool, but think of like winter in like San Francisco. You might not be growing your lemon trees and your crops and all that, but it's not like burr and snow drifts. And then down mm-hmm. like in Dorne by the appropriately named Summer Sea, it never gets cold.
Yeah.
However, during the legendary Long Night that lasted generations, apparently the winter spread over almost the entire globe and it almost killed all of mankind, and they were saved by Azor Ahai, the Lightbringer, who fought back the night and brought the dawn. So there doesn't seem to be any rhyme or reason that the maesters in the Citadel at Old Town kind of do some combination of like temperature recordings and celestial observations to predict when winter starts and to predict when it ends. But there was a war in like 100 years ago in Targaryen history called the War during the Fall Spring that implies that they're not always accurate. So
yeah,
I don't know what kind of fucked up astrophysics is going on here that causes this, or if it is an entirely magical phenomenon that is waxing and waning with the strength of the White Walkers and why the White Walkers have been hands off. There's a lot of really interesting lore and speculation and theories about that, but guess what? You got to be a book reader to play in that playground. So
they need more babies.
More babies.
Yeah.
They've been stockpiling babies for low 8,000 years, and that last one.
There's at least one at the wall.
That last one tipped the balance. Yeah, they're going to go get little Sam.
Yeah.
And then they're going to get little Sam.
He's gonna be sad that he sent his dragon glass with Jon
yeah.
when the White Walkers come.
I hope he kept, I don't know, he had several pieces. I hope he kept a few in reserve.
I hope so.
But again, it's very casual the way they're treating this dragon glass discovery.
Yeah, not as the savior of humankind.
Yeah. Like, the Black Brothers all believe in the fucking White Walkers. Yeah. They would be like, hey, why do we let the fat steward that nobody likes keep all of the ultimate weapon against the White Walkers?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, Gary L., hailing all the way from Australia, says, upon watching this episode, I couldn't help but notice the similarities between Ser Jorah's plotline and a certain story told by Littlefinger to Sansa in the Winterfell Crypts about Rhaegar Targaryen and Lyanna Stark. In that story, Rhaegar was the Winter of Eterni, who planted a crown of winter roses in front of Lyanna Stark, who was promised to Robert Baratheon, thus sparking the incident of Robert's rebellion. Jorah, on the other hand, is the winner of a lower fighting pits who plants Tyrion Lannister as a gift in front of Queen Daenerys in the presence of his Hisdar Zolorak, who is promised to Dany in marriage. Could the Double Ds be using the Rhaegar and Lyanna storyline to foreshadow the impending atrocities that could stem from Jorah's activities? Is Jorah Rhaegar and Dany Lyanna in this instance? Is it possible that Jorah presenting Tyrion as a gift to Dany to be a public display of his affection for her? This could potentially upset the political ties of Dany and Hisdar's marriage. And if it's not Hisdar he offends, could Jorah's love for Dany drive a wedge between Dany and Daario instead?
Yeah, all of those sound plausible.
He continues, seeing the way Daario behaved this episode, is it plausible for Daario to take his second sons to riot against Dany and form Daario's rebellion? Can we draw a connection between both stories as they were about men who publicly revealed their affections for a woman promised to another suitor of high royalty, which could provoke a hostile takeover? Additionally, the two instances of Tyrion embellishing the story about Jorah to the slave master last episode, and the slave master embellishing an even more exaggerated story of Jorah to the slave buyer in this episode, felt similar to the two instances of Rhaegar's story being recounted by Littlefinger to Sansa and Ser Barristan to Dany. The fact that Ser Barristan himself was also the opponent who lost to Rhaegar at the tourney helped pique my interest in these connections. Is it an interesting coincidence or foreshadowing? What say you, Jim?
I think it could be foreshadowing. Like, the thing that I pulled out of that I thought was interesting, because I don't know a ton about the backstory here, is Daario versus Jorah sort of deal. We know that Daario wants to get back into the fighting pits, right? He did it because he loved it. He might actually want to fight in these things. I could see an outcome where Jorah and Daario have to fight in the pits.
Like Jorah's fighting for his freedom.
And Daario's just fighting because he's Daario.
Daario's like, yeah, I'll be the queen's champion just because I'm an asshole.
Yeah.
That'd be kind of entertaining.
I think that'd be super awesome. All right. See those guys fight.
Okay. Who are you rooting for?
Oh, God damn it.
I don't feel like you like either of them.
You know, I probably like Daario more than Jorah.
Ah, see, I'm a Daario fan.
I feel bad for Jorah. I feel like he got the short end of the stick. Events played out, which caused him to look way worse than he is. Mm. And I know Daario isn't as interesting as he was in the books, but I don't know. He's grown on me.
Okay. I'm not even sure it's fair to say he's not as interesting as he did in the books. It's just that it might be fair to say that Daario is not interesting. I like Jorah.
Really? Okay.
My money's on Jorah. Hmm.
All right.
He got Khaleesi zoned. That ain't right. He needs to be able to fight for whatever he's got left at this point. I mean,
they've established that they're both badasses, right?
So let me ask you this.
Yeah.
Is Dany ever going to see Jorah as anything more than like a father figure?
I can't imagine that.
That's the thing. He's barking way up the wrong dragon on this thing.
I think you're right.
So whatever end he's in for, it can't be a happy ending as defined by himself.
Yeah, and given her reaction this episode, he might never even get back in her good graces.
And the way he said Khaleesi, please, it doesn't seem like he's learned his lesson. Like, I was impetuous and I assumed too much and I need to serve her because she's a person who needs to be serving. I mean, all the stuff that he said to Tyrion, the way he said Khaleesi, please, made it seem like he is still like a little love sick puppy.
Okay.
I don't know. That's my take on it. Brian J said, I'm curious about the supposed tradition of having the queen go around to all the minor league fighting pits before the season opens. How could this possibly be a tradition for the Monarchs if Meereen has never had a queen before Dany got there? I think her fiance may be full of shit. Really?
That's a good point.
Really? Another daily blowjob theory. That is a really strong point. They've made great pains to say that this was ruled by a council of wise masters.
Yeah.
And there's no mention of a king or queen in Meereen recent history. What the fuck?
That Hisdar guy, he's fishy. Yeah, no, that's super interesting.
Rob from San Jose says, I'm wondering if instead of a weapon, Sansa stole the metal piece as a means to pick her lock.
Sure.
Timing is everything. If Cersei chooses to plead mercy, as she just revealed was an option, she would not only dethrone her son Tommen, but inadvertently put her daughter and possibly Jaime in danger. By Jamie's accommodations, I feel like he will be let go, but if they hear before he leaves that his daughter is an incest bastard, they will be pissed. Also, if Tommen is no longer king, is Cersei back to being queen? Could Gendry reappear? If she is, I feel she could be tried for more than just the laws of seven infractions and a treason type charge under normal law, though it's unknown who would take over to enforce it. Good question. If Tommen is revealed to be the product of incest, who runs King's Landing?
It doesn't seem like anybody does.
I mean, I feel like
the throne is vacant.
We talk
at
about
that
the queen consort, king consort. I don't feel like Cersei could ever rule as queen.
No, so
she could be the queen mother and all that stuff, but I don't think she could politically be. I mean, again, you are whatever your armies can make you. So there is that possibility she could take the throne by force again and rule as the eternal queen, whatever. But yeah, I don't know.
I don't know. I mean, maybe in that situation she has the best claim. But he doesn't actually say, the High Septon does not say what the penalty is if you plead the mercy of Mother Nature or whatever it's called.
Mercy of the Mother.
The mercy of the Mother. There's still a penalty, but I don't know what that is. So, like, I wonder if Cersei would be allowed to take the role of queen over again. Because certainly Tommen couldn't. Marjorie couldn't take queen.
I think it would, honestly, it would go back to Stannis. Like, if there was no true-born legitimate sons of Robert
Baratheon. He's not around, you know?
No, but I'm
How's
saying...
he going to be, like, sworn in or
whatever? I don't know how they'd handle him being absent, but I think that the strongest claim would be, you know, as he's always said, me.
Yeah.
It goes back up through, once you run out of sons, it goes back
what
up
about
through...
Kevin? Kevin's non-absent.
Kevin's not ever king. The Lannisters were never on the throne. The only reason the Baratheons
were
because they... You know, the Baratheons were an offshoot of Targaryens hundreds of years ago.
Yeah, okay. So Kevin doesn't really have a claim. I don't know.
But it's all, I mean, that's the whole point. Like, the whole Baratheon claim was very Baratheon, was all kind of like smoke and mirrors bullshit anyway. Mm-hmm. The point of it is might made right. The fact that Robert and Ned and Jon Arryn could get more better men and defeat the Targaryens in open combat, that's why... they sat the throne, not because of any kind of blood claim. It's ridiculous.
Sure. I imagine the same would happen here with the Lannisters.
It would make it probably even more fucked up in King's Landing.
Yeah.
Which,
I would
again,
imagine so.
What is George playing at? What are the double D's playing at? We'll have to see. Emily W. says, about the Faith Militants. I wonder if they'll be arresting Qyburn anytime soon. I'm sure in the Seven Pointed Star, there's nothing about experimenting and resurrecting dudes from the dead. I find his character really interesting and want him to actually have a purpose, or else the double D's have been setting up his character for nothing.
Yeah, I got to say, the Mountain better come back within this season, or I'm going to be like, really, really?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they seem like they're moving that, scooting that plot pretty quickly along with all the reveals and stuff, and then we've had three episodes of nothing.
Yeah, next episode... the Mountain's going to go on a rampage against the Sparrows.
Tommen's going to unleash the Mountain that can't die.
Yeah.
Mildly interesting.
Command him to go get his mother and wife out of the dungeons.
Gregor smash. Also.
Bust through the walls like a Kool-Aid man.
Also, did people. That would be cool.
That would be.
Also, do the people like and want the Faith Militant? If King Tommen does decide to rage out and attack them, how would the people react? In the people's eyes, slaughtering the High Sparrow and all his followers is something Joffrey would have done. I hope Tommen is given a chance to prove himself a wise king, like what Tywin taught him at the start of season 4. We talked a lot about that already, and yeah.
I think it's plenty wise to go on a rampage here.
I think so, but I think it might be too late.
It might be.
The time to do that was the first or second instance you could have done it, not now.
Yeah,
when it's public and you got to fight through King's Landing, that's not easy. Ask Stannis. Hundreds might die, thousands.
Or you go to Littlefinger.
Ooh, now that's there. Littlefinger
starts talking a little.
The small council got a little bit bigger with the ironic addition of Littlefinger, didn't it?
It did. He's back. Is he? He's not really anything at this point, though, is he? He's not Master of Coin. We know that's Mace.
No,
I don't know that he's on the small council anymore, but he could certainly be.
There's so many. I mean, yeah. If Tom, that's the thing. It'd be interesting to see if he, without Cersei there to warn him or anybody to guide him, if could imagine what Littlefinger could do with the King of Westeros as his puppet.
Oh my God. If Holy you thought it was going to be interesting to see Tywin manipulate this kid.
Oh man. Oh man. Andy B said, are you aware that Jeremy Flynn is actually an established singer? He and his partner, Robin Green, had a string of hits in the 90s in the United Kingdom. Huh. I actually was aware of this because when he first appeared, I got to see a lot of interesting YouTube videos of him. Mm-hmm. But yeah, if you search for Jeremy Flynn singer, you get a lot of his like old videos and stuff from the 90s, like kind of Tears for Fears-esque stuff.
Wow.
It's pretty entertaining.
All right, I'm going to have to check that out.
Yeah. That's actually all the email we've got for Game of Thrones.
Oh, wow. Small email section this time.
It was. Well, there was, unfortunately, like last week, a lot of the Sansa stuff boiled over, and I made the editorial decision that I'm exhausted. I'm exhausted about talking that.
Yeah.
I think it's bullshit. I think it's stupid, and I said that, and I would just be arguing with listeners or saying right on as it is. So it's like, I think everyone knows my thoughts on it, and our collective thoughts, and you know, I would like to see the Double D's learn something from this, unlike the whole Cersei Jaime stuff from last year. We'll see.
Next time Ramsay comes in there thinking he's going to get screwed, he really is.
He's going to get the bunghole bore.
I don't think it's called the bunghole bore.
It is, because that's the thing. Like, it's not called a bunghole because it looks like a butthole. Our buttholes are called bungholes because they look like the thing on the cast.
I thought it was called a bung bore.
It is, because it bores out the bunghole. What do you think is left behind when the bung bore does its work? A bung hole.
You said you weren't going to make any jokes about this.
I'm not making a joke about that. I'm making a joke about the science and architecture of bungs, holes, and barrels.
Yeah.
Talking barrels, Jim. Get your head out of
the gutter. There's a lot to dissect there. More on that in the spoiler edition, I'm sure.
The spoil bore section.
Oh, boy.
It's all bores are all the time.
All right, that's
it. Don't want to step on the boar swords and goats guys' toes.
Oh, yeah. They're changing their name to Bung Boar Swords and Goats.
They got way more swords and goats than I do.
All right, that's it for the episode.
Want to give them a run on the boar department, though.
We will, yeah. We've got plenty of boars that need killing. Robert Baratheon's not around, so we can kill him now.
Bungs need boring.
That's it?
Yeah, send any feedback you got for the spoiler section. Not too late. The cutoff of that is around midday Thursday. Game of Thrones at baldmove.com. We'll have that out Friday. And then, of course, we'll be back on Sunday night for the instant cast and then the following Tuesday for the full cast on the next show. You can also follow us on facebook.com/baldmove and over on Twitter @baldmove. And please participate in our forums. They're kind of rocking on forums.baldmove.com. There's a spoiler and non-spoiler thread for each show, and a good time is being had by all.
Indeed. We'll be back. Well, you'll be back on Friday.
Yeah.
I'll be back right after the episode next week.
Mm-hmm.
And until then, I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron. See ya.